This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. How to sum up the terrible, horrible, no good year of 2020? It was a train wreck, a dumpster fire, a meadow muffin sandwich soaked in hogwash.
We were, most of us, only dimly aware of a far-off virus that was slowly, perhaps, making its way to the United States. Our first COVID story was back in January with Alexis Madrigal, one of the journalists behind the COVID tracking project. We discussed the relentless spread of confusing, conflicting information online, including the viral primal scream from a tweeting Harvard-affiliated public health researcher.
So, you know, he's sitting at home, is reading a paper that has not been peer-reviewed, but that researchers had put up on the internet so that they could kind of share it with each other. And he tweets, "Holy Mother of God, the new coronavirus is a 3.8. How bad is that reproductive R-naught value? It is thermonuclear pandemic level bad." Multiple exclamation points. You know, this thread took off and, of course, attributed to Harvard epidemiologist.
Madrigal called it a socially constructed number, describing both the initial contagion and what the government does in response. He said that the tweeting public health researcher, though ultimately justified in his panic, had gotten a little ahead of his skis. It was one of the first bits of COVID arcana we would encounter, the R-naught.
But as the virus burned through us, so did the associated lexicon. Words and phrases like case fatality rate, flattening the curve, social distancing, droplet transmission, viral shedding, super spreader, cytokine storm, and COVID-19. In February, we heard this from Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases.
It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness. I had a conversation with my family over breakfast this morning, and I told my children that while I didn't think that they were at risk right now, we as a family need to be preparing for significant disruption of our lives.
Also in February, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Lori Garrett, an interview that frankly electrified our staff for what it revealed about what we then knew and didn't. I told Lori we had advised listeners that if the CDC says to worry, then we should. But if it says don't worry, then don't. I asked, is that still true?
Well, let's see how that played out this week at the White House.
Here's the president's tweet from a short time ago, blaming the media. He says low ratings and fake news. Comcast and CNN are doing everything possible to make the coronavirus look as bad as possible.
Rush Limbaugh had fueled this.
The coronavirus being weaponized as yet another element to bring down Donald Trump.
Now, I clarify this. Dr. Nancy Messonnier of the Centers for Disease Control, which today warned it could be bad, it might be bad, is the sister of the former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
Oh. The president will make some assertion, or one of his economic advisors will make an assertion, all intended clearly to calm the stock markets.
Like the director of his National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow.
I don't want to negate it. I'm just saying all I can do is look at the numbers.
Yeah,
the
and
numbers
Larry
are saying the U.S. is holding up nicely.
All of it meant to undermine this notion that America is facing a grave risk. So the question is, who are we believing? We've not had a serious epidemic in the United States, except HIV, in well over 100 years. we witness the pain, the agony, the struggles from afar. You know, Zika in Brazil or Ebola in Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, we're really facing the probability that we will not just be witnessing, we'll be experiencing. And then we'll find out, what is the mettle of Americans?
And as she predicted 10 months ago, we saw reflections of ourselves in its terrible wake, suspicious and resentful, just as we had been in kindred disasters centuries ago.
The bubonic plague in the 14th century shows what are our relationships to our fellow human beings.
In March, we spoke to Frank Snowden, professor emeritus of the history of medicine at Yale University and author of Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. An epidemic, he writes, holds a mirror to the civilization.
You read in Boccaccio about the terror from the plague. Husband left wife and vice versa. Parents fled their children. One can see the scapegoating, the search for a demonic influence. This is not something that we ourselves did, of course. It's always some other group or person that we want to blame. The hunt for witches, pogroms against Jews, xenophobia unleashed society's coming to a halt. It's something that seems, alas, to be with us since the very beginning. We can see it in homophobia, in the American epidemic of HIV/AIDS, and the assault on Asian people today.
I want to move on to an infection bedeviling Napoleon. Let's start with his invasion of Russia in 1812, where his superior armies were overrun not by the Tsar's troops, so much as what?
Oh, dysentery and typhus. His military tactics were predicated on lightning strikes and sudden rapid movement. He wanted his army not to be laden down with supplies and with food, but to live off the land. And so he marched an army that was 500,000 men. Imagine the whole city of Paris going into Russia, and Napoleon having decided not to take medical supplies, bandages, or sanitary precautions of any kind at the time. And so they went into Russia, marching for this vast distance in what was the immediate creation of what we might call a terrible urban slum, living in the dung of the animals and that they themselves made, drinking water that was polluted in the rivers. And very soon they were immersed in a tremendous outbreak of dysentery that was killing something like 3,000 men a day. Then after Moscow, Napoleon finally decides that they can't survive a winter in Moscow. He has to return to France. Napoleon himself took off in a sled with a bodyguard and abandoned his troops. Only about 10 to 15,000 returned to France, and almost all of those 480,000 or so died of first the dysentery and then the typhus, and there was regime change in France, and disease had a major role in that.
In the midst of coronavirus, you're thinking of Napoleon and feeling a bit of deja vu.
I think about Napoleon a lot because it seems that he's a model of how not to react to the threat of disease that was about to overwhelm the 500,000 men he was commanding and the larger society and empire for which he was responsible. He reacted by doing something that sounds very similar to the present day, by saying it was false facts. We don't need to think about these diseases, we're going to march on ever forward. So Napoleon seems to be someone who had contempt for the impact of the environment, nature, disease, and the threat that it posed. not willing to think of this in terms of planning and mobilizing resources and deploying them in the way that people with knowledge and science and the lessons of history all urge should be done.
And to your earlier point, he seems to take as a personal political assault the behavior of microbes.
Napoleon took great umbrage that a disease could harm the almighty emperor of the French.
Month after month, the virus taught us more about how our nation works and how it doesn't, the disproportionate impact on communities of color and on warehoused elderly alone in their final hours, but for the healthcare workers, so-called essential workers, who put themselves so much at risk. Essential worker, that's another term with which we've grown familiar. Usually low-wage workers who can't afford to stay home. They keep the wheels from falling off the jalopy that is our national life. So they are celebrated as essential, but too often treated as disposable, taken for granted.
So much taken for granted, human beings most of all, but also classroom chatter, weddings, movies, concerts, theaters, and bars, and especially, well, let's just say we had to learn a lot more about the supply chain, another phrase now in vogue, just to comprehend where all the TP went.
As everywhere, there's been an inexplicable run on toilet paper.
Fights over toilet paper breaking out in grocery stores as shelves run empty.
The shelves are empty, no toilet paper.
Turns out we weren't hoarding. At least not that much, at least not at first. It's just that the toilet paper didn't follow us home when our offices closed. The reason, tech writer Will Oremus explained, is that it's not the same paper.
It's two totally different products. One of them is thin, flimsy, it comes in huge rolls, whereas the kind you buy in the store is often embossed and layered and cushy. And it's actually often different companies producing these two different kinds of toilet paper. If you were making toilet paper for the commercial market and now you want to send it to drugstores and grocery stores, you've got to make new contracts. You've got to figure out new shipping routes, who's going to be driving that toilet paper, who's going to be dropping it off and when, how it'll be priced, how it'll be packaged. That all takes time. It's not the only product that works like this. Grocery stores have been selling out of bananas. The bananas that you get at your workplace, you know, at the cafeteria, they are small and they come loose, whereas the ones you buy in the store are big and bright and they come in bunches. And again, we have two different supply chains there. And then there's the beer industry, where a company like Anheuser-Busch, usually a lot of its beer is put into kegs and sent to restaurants and bars. Well, that is kind of out the window.
Another big lesson we learned is that in our overheated, enraged nation, everything but everything is politics. Even when hundreds of thousands of lives are at stake, people are still moved like pawns by evasions and lies. And though it has finally come to pass that trusted media outlets know they are obliged to call out the lies, other influential outlets merely amplify them.
An Arizona man died after taking chemicals that he thought would protect him from coronavirus, and his wife is in the hospital this morning. The couple took chloroquine phosphate. Now, that is similar, but not exactly the same as the prescription drug chloroquine, something that the president had talked about.
What would be your message to the American public?
Don't believe anything the president says.
Now, why would you send a lie like that to your followers? You retweeted.
That was a retweet. That was an opinion of somebody, and that was a retweet. I'll put it out there. People can decide for themselves. I don't take a position.
You're not like someone's crazy uncle.
According to a Cornell University study, the president was the largest driver of the coronavirus misinformation infodemic, but he found able amplifiers in Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and Rush Limbaugh, and countless politicians. Also making a striking cameo, vaccine science denier Judy Mikovits, who sold a heap of books after starring in the 30-minute video, Plandemic.
The man who was heading the pandemic task force was involved in a cover-up.
He directed the cover-up. And in fact, everybody else was paid off, and paid off big time.
plandemic fueled the paranoid notion that the COVID-19 virus was concocted in American and Chinese labs, that flu vaccines actually increase your chance of getting COVID-19, as did wearing a mask.
In time of plague, lies may kill you, but the truth won't set you free. We've also learned this year about the perils of pandemic media overconsumption and the limits of our battered psyches, of even the luckiest of us, to stay focused on the devastation, even those whose job it is to sound the alarm.
You know, there was a statistic this week, and I'm sure by the time this goes to air, the statistic will be worse, but it was that more people had died on a day this week than on 9/11.
This earlier this month from our own producer-reporter, Michael Loewinger.
And on 9/11, when I was a little boy, I cried a lot, and I was very disturbed, and it shook up the way that I saw the world. And I haven't felt that intensely about this pandemic in a really long time, maybe at the very beginning. But the days just keep going, and the world is telling me, like, hey, there's as much tragedy as the biggest tragedy in recent American history. And so I should feel an equivalent amount of sadness. And I really don't. And I want to, and I understand it. And it's our job on the show and as citizens to understand it and to care. But if I'm being utterly honest, I just don't feel that sadness every day.
I asked what good it did the dead and the dying to feel their pain.
You know, it's something like a bell curve. If you feel nothing, you do nothing. If you feel too much, you do nothing. But in the middle, there's some kind of sweet spot of action and of productivity and inspiration and motivation. And I fear I'm too far to the inactive side of the bell curve, the doing nothing, feeling nothing. You know, I'm going to survive. I'm going to be fine. The people around me, for the most part, are going to be fine and do okay. This is not an existential moment for me, but that doesn't mean I don't have a responsibility.
Coming up, 2020's lethal lies and terrible truths about the uprising.
This is On the Media.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.